Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foley, joined once again by Larkin Kemp. And Larkin, the Super Bowl is in the books and Nick Osello is nowhere to be found. Who are we going to blame? His jet-setting schedule or Alaska Airlines?
No one claims to be working harder with more questionable output, so I'm proud of him, but I'd just love to see his face and have him host one of these.
We've got a great slate of college lacrosse to discuss. Once again, disrupted by the weather, but not nearly as much as the weekend prior. I will say, hand up, I talked a lot of smack about back in my day, these games would have been played. And then I was walking from the parking lot to the Jones Hill House, is the name of the Maryland Terrapins indoor football practice facility. And even though I was going to be inside in the press box anyway, I still was like, it was a good decision to play this inside. It was brutally cold in the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast on Saturday. So kudos to all of the administrators for getting as many games in as we're getting in. We are going to start in Huluba Hall, where the Villanova Wildcats topped the Penn State Nittany Lions 14-13 in overtime. One caveat that is well known within the world of college lacrosse is beware overreacting to results in Huluba Hall and beware overreacting to early season Villanova upsets. But with that being said, for me, a game that the Nittany Lions got to be kicking themselves for giving up because they had a late lead that Villanova was able to extinguish, and got to give a lot of credit to the Wildcats. I'm going to steal a couple of Dan Kaplan's points here, so just blanket credit to him. But you know, his observation in general was that Villanova was good in every facet and not outplayed in any particular facet. I think, you know, as I was taking in the game, I was struck by, you know, Colin Michener is a Big Ten athlete, and he was able to go toe-to-toe with the Nittany Lions. But, you know, Luke Raymond is probably their best-known quantity at this point. And I thought, even though he was relatively held in check, he was very clearly the orchestrator. And then, you know, I think Nick Lucchese was the one who really stood out to me for his quickness, his spark, his slipperiness. It felt like he gave the important goals. He got one early, and then he got what I think was the 10th goal that sparked that late run in regulation that tied it up or led to it being tied up. And then ultimately, Dan Martin was the hammer. I'm going to use a curling term because we're recording this in the middle of the Winter Olympiad, and McNair's post-game story cited, I believe it was Raymond, who caught his Martin's overtime attempted game winner that got that went wide, went to Raymond, and then we passed it back to Martin. He said, hammer it, and that's exactly what he did. And we've got another early season Villanova upset in Huluba Hall. What did you take away from this one?
I think you did a good job laying out a lot of kind of the things that caught my eye. I think Villanova is a very scary team to have on your schedule early in the year for a variety of reasons. They draw from the Philadelphia hotbed. They're big and strong on the back end, and they at least recently have had like one or two flashy guys up front. So I think everyone was keying in to see how Penn State's defense would look and whether even with some of the back end losses and some of the senior leadership that led them into the tournament last spring, whether kind of their like blue blood talent and Tambroni machine would kind of take over. And it went the other direction. I think where this gets fascinating is I think Villanova's really good early. I think Villanova, as we know, does not typically stay in the top 10 to 15 of RPI. So this is actually a matchup that does have implications on Penn State's season. And it's one that I think will rightfully, you know, Quint kind of framed it, I think, appropriately, which is, listen, they're not a top five group now. Let's take a step back. Let's see how Aquino and co mesh up front. Let's see, you know, where the rope unit gets in terms of getting stops. And we put them back down a tier into kind of like wait and see mode with the Virginias, with the UNCs. So other than that, it's a gutsy win. Like, you know, Penn State deserves to be thought of as a team that is ready to play and well coached. I feel very strongly about both coordinators they have, so I think Villanova deserves credit.
Yeah, Penn State, you know, you look at this one and you're like, well, they didn't lose because they scored 13 goals, right? It wasn't as if they needed to score more. But, you know, again, with a tip of the cap to Dan Kaplan, one of the points that he made was that they were legitimately running four midfield lines, and it feels like they're trying to figure out their personnel. And there are ways in which that should come as no surprise. Obviously, the move of Aquino from midfield to attack has been, I think, what we've talked the most about as a staff. A freshman in Jack Yanantuano, which is going to be one of the most difficult names to pronounce for the course of the next 4 years, he's emerged as a solid presence down there as well, and as the facilitating and feeding presence. Liam Matthews, who was rightfully in the conversation as a borderline All-American by the time the season ended last year, missed game one but played in this one and finished with one assist. Chase Robertson, the transfer from Utah, to my eye, is on another level as far as his pop and ability to get a step consistently. And I think, especially if you're going to keep Aquino at attack, he and Robertson are very complementary in terms of how they need to be guarded by opponents. And so it feels like that's going to be another key area of focus. And then that leaves, you know, some known commodities, known quantities like Kyle Laneman and Luke Wallstrom that have to find their footing and find their role. And that's before you even get to the fact that, you know, Michael Ferrone, who a pretty well-known commodity coming out of high school, had a good season, or I'm sorry, a good week last week, and it was held in check this week, right? And you know, it was another guy that in some ways kind of looked a little bit like a monster and like he was going to be able to contribute something. So point is that there are obviously questions to be answered at that end of the field. At the other end of the field, you know, the focus has been on their performance in net and starting a freshman in Preston Hawkins. And it'll be freshman goaltending tends to go one of two ways, right? We saw this in Cornell 2 years ago where ultimately it just the answer didn't emerge as the season went along. Other times, especially if there's strong commitment to working through, weathering the storms, working through the tough spots, then you can find that consistency, solidity of performance as you get through the meat of a non-conference schedule. And then ultimately when the games matter the most, that's when kind of the rubber meets the road. Obviously, in Alex Ross, we know who they have defensively, but you know, with the at the risk of giving short shrift to Villanova, I think it is fair to come away from this result, to your point, trying to isolate what does Penn State need to learn from this one and build on going forward. And then equivalently, you know, as Villanova turns around and takes on a St. Joe's team that's licking its wounds after getting blottoed by the Orange in the JMA Wireless Dome, you know, let's see them continue to stack, right? And I think that those are reasonable approaches to take to reacting to this result.
Yeah, the other thing that's interesting, just to call it out, it's not as if Nova got saves and the refs did not insert themselves into this game. Like, only one foul, right? The ground ball delta is effectively just the face-off delta. So, like, it pretty even off the deck. You know, clears were fairly efficient both directions. So, it really, if you wanted to build, like, a bear thesis for Penn State, that's somewhat alarming, right? They actually won the goaltending battle. Right. You know, Nova only had five saves.
I think it would be a disservice not to shout out Jake Melchione. And, you know, I don't like to impose what I think appeals to you about certain players, but a long stick midi with a nose for the offensive end of the field who finished with six ground balls and two caused turnovers feels like a Larkin Kemp type player. He was a New Balance All-American, and his handle and the smoothness with which he picks up the ball off the ground is near the top of everyone in college lacrosse. A worth the price of admission player for sure.
Love it. One to watch. I think we have a bunch of polls actually we can handle this year. So we could see some people emerge with some monster stats, which is fun.
That is increasingly true. And a handful of them played in Charlottesville, Virginia, which is where we are going to go next. Not quite a tale of two halves, but certainly a you know, tale of, call it, 2/3 and a third. This was a really tight game in the third quarter, with Colgate giving the Cavaliers everything that they could handle on a narrow field, once again played indoors at the Cavaliers football practice facility. And ultimately, Virginia was able to pull away late for the 19-14 victory. When you look at the box score, McCabe Millen, 4 goals and 5 assists. Truett Sunderland, 6 goals and 2 assists. Ryan Colsey, 4 goals and an assist. Brendan Millen, 5 assists, notably starting out of the midfield. Equivalently, this is the second game in a row that Colgate has put up 14 on a power conference opponent, having lost to Penn State 18-14 in their opening game last weekend. Casey Quinson, 4 goals. Freddie Fowler, 3-1. Hunter Druin, the best known commodity, 2-2. Ryan Favaro, 2-1. So obviously there was a lot of focus on the loss of Rory and Liam Connor, a grad transfer and an undergrad transfer to Georgetown, who we have yet to see in action. But for me, the interesting thing about Colgate was not just the loss of them, but the general kind of graduation losses that they have continued to backfill over the course of the last 3 to 4 seasons. In addition to that, just the increased familiarity with both the tempo that they play and the demands of the 10-man ride. And you know, as more teams start to play it, and certainly Virginia has played a bunch of different types of rides over the course of Lars Tiffany's tenure, and you could assume that from a clearing standpoint, the Cavaliers both should have the athletes to punt return if that's what they need to do, as well as the familiarity with how to try to get the ball up and out if that's the preferred method. Ultimately, you know, I thought this was a game where riding and clearing was not easy. I think Virginia failed 3 clears. I want to say Colgate failed either 5 or 6. But at the same time, the helter-skelter nature, I think, would have been persistent even if both teams cleared really well, because it was the pace that really emanated from, you know, just through the screen on Sunday afternoon, combined with the proficiency of ball movement, the frequency with which there was a guy open on the backside uncovered, and in general, as both goalies finished a shade over or under 40%, the paucity of saves. What'd you take away from Virginia's 19-14 win over Colgate?
Yeah, so I watched this one more or less in full. I think there's two buckets of thought. The first, which is probably the most interesting to the country, would be the Virginia offense, specifically the Millen brothers. I think people overcorrected based on the film last year and are dramatically misrepresenting what the chemistry of that offense can be and their ability to fill it up. Like, to use a, you know, an alternative metaphor, like Quinn Hughes is better with Jack Hughes. Like, they know each other well, they're both more confident, they settle in earlier. Like, they hopefully will be a problem for Canada and for Sweden in you know, the Olympic Games that get started this week. And you can just kind of extrapolate that thought into, listen, McCabe had a lot on his shoulders last year. It feels like even just watching his body language, he's a little bit more settled in and more confident with Brennan behind the net. I think, so specific to that side of the field, they look better. Like, they look more athletic. I thought Colgate could not bump and recover quick enough to get down to Sunderland on, like, basically the backside C cut. So it was really simple, almost high school level offense. It's going to take more against a Maryland or, you know, Syracuse. So I'm not ready to anoint them contenders in the ACC, but I think that side of the ball is a lot better than the nation currently thinks. And I expect them to kind of, like, regress to the norm in terms of output. I also think Coach Cassis he knows what he's doing, you know. I think Lars and him have great chemistry. I've been with them in a room together. They're grinding on that side of the ball. So I would be buying stock there. The flip side of that argument, which was hard for me to articulate because I care deeply about the man and obviously want him and his unit to be humming, is I think there were a lot of holes on the back end. Like, I did not think they were playing great downers. Like, the connective tissue between their string to their four-man into five-man back in what they call rules was not where it needed to be. You know, Colgate, like, was hyper efficient. Like, they got a ton of great looks from the center of the field. I did not think the short stick D mids were doing a great job of determining, like, which direction and slide communications and things like that. So listen, not every schedule is made the same. Like, would the Virginia defense be totally fine in the Ivy this year? I think they would. But as we know, I mean, this is a program with massive expectations. So a lot of those young poles are going to have to grow up quite quick, including that freshman LSM, who looks pretty. Yeah, Hopper, who looks good in transition. Like, he's no question he's going to be good. But yeah, I'll kind of pause there. Like, I'm torn because as a stock, I think Virginia is undervalued. Like, I think that people have kind of forgotten how recently they were a successful culture, and like, this is the classic case of you overcorrect and leave them for dead, right? But with that being said, I did not think Saturday's film was great, or Sunday, sorry.
So my question for you is, when you talk about the defensive end of the field, one criticism that I've had voiced to me a few times is Lars has fallen in love with the athletic profile at the expense of the ability to communicate or just the intuitive understanding of how to play. I generally reject it because, you know, this team was really good a couple years ago with Cade Sostad and, Cole Kastner. And, you know, those guys are nothing if not the athletic profile. So I think, you know, where I come at it from is John Schroeder hurt his ankle in the scrimmage against Yale. So they had a week to prepare for not starting their number one. But at the same time, they also had spent the preseason preparing to have Schroeder, right? It's not, you know, the same as a situation where, you know, a guy was lost for the year in the fall or something along those lines. And then equivalently, the injuries that they've sustained at the short 60 midi position where they were without Joey Terenzi and will be without Will Erdman for the year further compounds that. And then to your point, you know, Hopper got run in a trio of LSMs. So I guess there's this, and it's true for every team at this time of year, right? Like, trying to develop continuity as quickly as you can, to the extent that continuity is the secret sauce, the important factor in chemistry and being on a string and covering up the backside and all that amoeba-like movement in out where it's in unison. But also, you know, to the part that I started with about falling in love with the profile, it's like, yeah, when you have a bunch of guys who are 6'5 and eat space, you don't actually have to be in as good a unison because you have so much makeup ability in the context of that size being able to eat space. So, taking us back to the 2015-16 range that we talked about last week, how important was size and athleticism toward getting the stops that you guys got? And how much do you think that has either carried with Lars's point of view coaching defense at Virginia, or how much do you think it's shifted because of the type of athletes you can recruit to Charlottesville that you couldn't get to Providence?
It's a loaded question. I mean, the reality is anytime you can get a 6'5 space eater, you have to take a swing on him, right? If he has a chance to be a Michael Earhart or a, you know, Jesse Bernhardt or a Tucker Durkin, it's the job of the head ball coach to go get the best possible athletes on the front end as a recruit. I think Virginia and Lars, but also I would put Duke in this bucket. I would put UNC there. I would certainly put Syracuse there, have been caught between a rock and a hard place of trying to like adjust their, you know, annualized scheme for what is this group of individuals like optimal, you know, what structure should they be in and what frequency should we slide versus like what Tillman, of course, has created is this is what we do. Like, it doesn't matter who the group of poles is this specific season. Like, this is the rate at which we come, and we very rarely, you know, change that. I also think what gets tough is when you win national championships the way Lars did early in his tenure at Virginia by just playing fast, like, it's actually okay to give up looks because that increases the likelihood that Shelley gets another touch at GLE, and that increases the likelihood that, like, Krause is free on the left wall. And more touches equals more goals, and, like, Kerwin and that offense were producing at a level where that made sense. I've said it a million times. It's not because I'm biased. Lars is an elite defensive mind. Like, he... if you polled the coaches and you just said, hey, you have one guy who needs to run like a man down for one stop, Lars would be very close to the top of that list. It's just a question of getting this unit spinning the way they need to, where, you know, they're not as reliant on like the over-the-head takeaway versus just, hey, that's a hell of a U-turn. And to be clear, we're going to talk about Jacksonville in a second versus UNC. I put UNC in the exact same bucket. So it's not specific to Charlottesville, but when you have the pressure that you have on those athletes on the other side, and when they're a little bit younger and a little bit more unproven, like, I don't think we can expect Brendan Millen to like run by, you know, the Maryland close defense. I think he's a good player. I think he's going to produce this year. So I'm sure he's grinding on it. And now, to be clear, it's better to see it now on film. It's actually better to get scored on and to have the attention of the Hoppers and the short 6D midfield group that's still growing up, so that he can coach them through it. And, you know, like I said, I think this is a team that is certainly dangerous. No question about it.
One of the things that is a distinction, in my opinion, between Carolina and Virginia is, how long has it been since Virginia polls were confident that a mediocre to good shot was going to get saved, relative to how long has it been for Carolina? Where I would argue, you know, certainly last year and in the last several years, Carolina has had a lot of confidence in their goaltending in a way that Virginia has not, really, since Alex Rhode left Charlottesville. And bad goaltending can make good defense look bad. And, you know, it's not to say that that isn't also true the other way. Bad defense can make good goaltending look bad. So it's the most inextricable part of the sport, right? It's like trying to unwind pitching and defense in baseball. It's so dependent that it's really difficult to isolate the variables until you get into the film room and start to identify, were those the shots that on Friday in our pregame we talked about being comfortable giving up?
Yeah, I think it's such a great call out, and it's a piece of the game that the casual observer, they really just don't realize the delta with how you can play, specifically in man down, specifically in zone, specifically in late approach sequence. So, like, if we've already been beat and now we're sliding, the pace at which I have to slide to the backside, right, the difference between, hey, we're totally comfortable with this kid banging from 15, hands-free, versus, like, we are selling our soul to get out there because anything, you know, is going today, right? That is, like, such a difference as a defense. And what that leaves, by the way, is the exact way they were scoring on the other side of the field. That's how you get the Sunderlands getting six goals, right? Is like Colgate's flying around trying to get out on hands.
Colgate also just flies around all the time because that's what they
do. Yeah. As they should, by the way. That's how you win at a non, you know, ACC talent recruiter. Like, to win, you know, coming from the programs that are lesser than, let's call it, you have to play a unique style of defense, right? A really good example being when Denver women made the Final Four, they like revolutionized zone in the women's game. It's been a long time, and now everyone plays it. Like, that's a really interesting kind of like thought process to consider this bucket. But yeah, UVA needs set. They need saves. Like, they, you know, they need saves, and I think that in particular they need this team's version of John Fox to emerge, which was a name from their championship teams, where it's like, he wouldn't look as explosive in the weight room versus like a Houseman or versus a whoever, but he knows what Lars needs, and he knows like the rate of slide. And like that's why short 16 middies are so critical to championship runs.
It'll be interesting to see whether or not Wills Burt is the guy that does that. Because obviously with Hudson and with Terenzi, you know, they're the two-way guys, right? You know, and so it's not to say that you can't expect the two-way guy to be the one that's the lockdown kind of organizer shorty-wise. It's just not typically going to be what you get out of that role.
Yeah, it's better if it's not. It's better if it's like an elder statesman, does not play O, can talk to Lars every time he comes off the field, is the only guy who plays man down, you know, is the smartest guy out there. Like, that's what you want. You want just kind of like a mental savant. The Luke Kuechly, for people who saw the video of him just like calling out the plays before it happened, that went viral this week. That's what you're looking for, but I'll pause.
The last thing I'll say about this game and the last thing I'll say about Virginia is I was somebody who said that the difference between going 6-8 last year, which is what they did, versus 9-5 was the offensive end of the field. And it was a diagnosis that I came away from their scrimmage against Navy and Marquette feeling, which was the injuries to Dunkel, Colsey, and Sean Brown were going to limit the talent quotient that they had at that end of the field. And to me, when you look at what Ryan Dunkel and Charles Bolsamo are giving, it fits into effectively what the talent, they're in the roles that are appropriate for their talent. I think that was ultimately like one of the fundamental issues last year, is that everybody was in a role that was like one step too onerous for what they were going to be capable of based on who they were as players last year. And McCabe is included in that. Or like, he was a number one offensive player, but he was still going through the adjustment of having been a number three playing alongside the likes of Connor Schellenberger and Peyton Cormier the year before. And so, you know, we've talked about how there was always going to be that built-in adjustment, and that was what last year was. So now he's so much closer to being a bona fide number one who's capable and used to taking on opponent number ones. But now you add Brendan Millen to the equation alongside Colsey and Sunderland, and then you put, you know, Dunkel and Bolsamo in that 5 and 6 role, and it's just way more appropriate for you know, what their skill set suggests that they're able to do. And I think that'll be the part about how this chemistry emerges as the season continues to go along. That's going to be super interesting to follow. All right, let's go to College Park, where I was to see Maryland's 19-10 win over Loyola. Similar to the Virginia Colgate game, this was a close one through 35 minutes. The Terps were up 7-5 with 10 minutes to go in the third quarter, at which point they went on a 7-goal run. And it was a combination of transition goals. AJ Larkin got one in that span. And then Chris Lyons got a BTB with one second left. Not a transition goal, but certainly a juice goal. And then just a lot of step downs. And they came off good ball of movement. It came off of, you know, really good boa constrictor style offense out of the Terps. And for me, it was kind of always coming, because the Maryland had dominated the faceoff X through that point of the game. I think they were 18 and 23. They had won all 9 faceoffs in the third quarter. To end the game, Henry Dodge won 12 of 16, and Jonah Carrier won 8 of 11. Mitchell Lloyd came on in the fourth quarter and struggled a little bit, and that was when, you know, Loyola made a little bit of a run. Both teams scored 5 goals in the fourth. But it wasn't just the faceoff X. Loyola cleared pretty effectively, but they did have a failed clear or two in that first 35-minute stretch. What I thought was really damaging was the frequency with which really both goaltenders, but Loyola's Max Watkinson, who finished with 12 saves, was giving up rebounds. And I don't have the number at hand, but I believe on 2 of Maryland's first 5 goals, they came directly, not directly off rebounds in the sense that it was rebound, pick up the ball and immediately dunk it. It was more damaging than that, because it was full possession, good shot, good save, but didn't control the rebound. Maryland gets the ball, cycles it around, and even if they didn't eat up the whole 60 seconds, they still put even more lactic acid into the Loyola defender muscles. And so it, once that run finally did start, it felt to me like the inevitable dam being burst, because of how much pressure Loyola's defense had withstood through those 35 minutes. But despite that, I will say, you know, this is a Loyola team that had the worst season since Charlie Toomey had taken over as head coach in 2006. Last year, they made a change in offensive coordinator, and this is a game that they lost by a goal last year. So to say that it was a 9-goal loss showed improvement sounds ridiculous, and I'm fully conceding that. But I did like a lot of what I saw from the combination of, you know, offensively, ball movement. They scored on 33% of their possessions. Last year, they scored on 23% of their possessions for the season, not in this game. And then in terms of like the game long fight, right? They knew that this wasn't in contest, or the outcome wasn't in doubt down the stretch, but they continued to play hard and put in goals. And then just kind of the individual pieces and talent. For me, the result says way more about Maryland than it does about Loyola, and it says what you would kind of expect out of the number one team, which is that they're really effing good. And the box score kind of tells the story, I think, of what we all expected was going to be interesting about Maryland, which was, how do you take these two returning attackmen in Eric Spanos and Braden Urksa, who have earned everything in terms of what they want out of their senior years and then converge them with two grad transfer attackmen in Leo Johnson and Chris Lyons. They were teammates. They both played last season. Like Loyola, Yale had a low watermark year. And what was interesting was all along, the kind of default answer to the unknown question was, I don't know how you're going to play four attackmen, but if anybody's going to figure it out, it's going to be John Tillman and Mike Phipps. And through one game, as Chris Lyons is ISOing out of timeouts on the righty wing, getting to the doorstep and finishing a dive that looks like something Pat Spencer did 6 or 7 years ago, and he finishes with four goals, including that BTB to end the third that I talked about, and Johnson's putting up 5-1, Braden Urxa is facilitating with four assists, and Spanos has 2-1, and oh, by the way, last year's, I believe, number four, number five ranked overall recruit, Spencer Ford, who missed the year as and redshirted, you know, he's there for a rebound goal and scores another one, just showing off impressive IQ. And Elijah Stobaugh, the huge middie who actually looks like Chris Lyons kind of did at Yale, puts up two of his own. It's like, all right, here we are, putting up 19 against a seemingly pretty good Loyola team. Bonafide number one, and we'll see what that path to Memorial Day looks like as they head to the Carrier Dome to take on Syracuse at 6 o'clock on Friday night, a battle of 1 and 2 and what's going to be one of the most anticipated games of the year. And certainly the highlight of February.
Not much more I can add. That was beautiful. The only thing I'd say is
there's always just something you can add. Don't sell yourself.
Just because of the nature of, you know, the Ivy film that I watched. Like I don't think people realize how hurt Lyons has been the last 2 years. His 23 season at Yale, like he was putting up 4 or 5 goals a game. And I think was, you know, ended with like maybe mid-60s. Like he was filling the net against pretty good teams. This is not a irrelevant to whether you think he'll be able to like dodge on poles all year. Like he can flat out fill it up. Like he can shoot. And when you put that into, it's kind of like when you see the really impactful college basketball transfers where it's like Tillman has a system. It works. We already have Spanos and Urxa, as you laid out perfectly. Now we can kind of insert these other veteran pieces. And as we've talked about at length on this podcast, you know, when the Notre Dame team was, you know, made its run and Tevlin was a part of it, there's a very powerful thing in like a grad student who no longer has to take like Yale econ classes and now is just like all in on trying to win a ring at a school that adores lacrosse. You know, he's effectively a professional athlete this year, right? And that's exactly the reason John Tillman went after those guys. And unlike some of the other teams that this has been tried at, like they have the perfect defense to be the grad insurgent offense, right? Like they're just going to fall back on fundamentals. Just to double down on what you said, I'm really curious to see how Loyola responds this year. Like I think the sport's better, obviously, when Loyola is not only competitive, but when that building's full and like when those early season matchups in particular are like a way to draw fans in, whether it be with Hop. Or with, you know, any other regional rivals. So it's, you know, it's one of the best buildings in the sport. Toomey's, you know, been doing it a long time. I love Wardo. So, like, it's just one we're going to have to watch. It's, you know, they got to climb their way back up in a competitive Patriot, but it'll be fun.
Yeah, you know, just to that point, we're going to see the Blue Jays on Tuesday afternoon against Towson. That'll be revealing both directions. And then Hopkins Loyola on Saturday, right? So we're going to learn a lot about the Baltimore landscape over the course of the next 6 days. But let's take it down to Chapel Hill. You tease it already. North Carolina survives against the Dolphins of Jacksonville. The second one goal loss to a Power 5 opponent that the John Galloway's team has sustained so far this season. I'm going to give you a lot of ground on this one because it was a corner of the eye for me before I hit the road to cover that Loyola Maryland game. But one of the things that stands out is Drew Rypien, 12 of 23 against Brady Wambach, my first team preseason All-American at the Faceoff X. And then in goal, Ryan Della Rocca, 15 saves, his second straight really impressive performance. And then, you know, you referenced Quinn's top 20 column earlier in the podcast, and I'm going to double down on a point that he made, which I didn't realize in the time, which is that Dom Petromal and Owen Duffy combined to shoot 0 of 12, and Duffy's, I believe, two assists were the only points that the duo put up. It was Mason Souček, Brevin Wilson, Ty English, Luke Macaluso carrying a lot of the offensive burden for the Tar Heels, and then Jack Taylor with a goal and three assists. Once again, an impressive performance out of him to lead the Dolphins in scoring. What'd you see out of this one?
This was shocking. Because of the nature of how limited the slate was last weekend, I would say a higher percent of lacrosse fans watched that Rutgers-Jacksonville game in full. So you have a pretty good sense of what Jacksonville brings to the table. At no point when I was watching that game did I think that Owen Duffy or Dom would get bageled. And I certainly didn't think that we would be in like a high school-style shootout late where, you know, coaching decisions come into, you know, play, you know, ISO matchups where it's like young Mitty on short stick late. The whole thing was stunning. I'm sure the Jacksonville staff is still kicking themselves and not burning their timeout sooner. They wasted about 55 seconds when they got the rock back, kind of like probing around, not actually attacking. It's one of the most frustrating things for coaches, for all the young Mitties listening. Like what they're hoping you're going to do is take advantage of a tired rope unit and like dodge hard. And if you get into any form of trouble, they'll call the timeout then, set up whatever they want to do, and not allow Petro to talk to his poles. That's like what the offensive staff is thinking. But the key to that is you have to dodge. Like you have to go, and you have to try and generate leverage. So I'm sure that's eating at them. I mean, these poor guys were in two absolute heartbreakers back-to-back. But like just to get to the brass tacks of it, there is a huge percentage of the country who thinks or thought Owen Duffy is probably the main competitor to Joey Spallina, both in terms of like brand recognition, but also in terms of potential point production to be on the stage at the Toroton celebration. So it was in no way am I suggesting he's not going to bounce back. It's just like it catches your eye. You're like, wait, is he not just winning his matchup and kind of doing whatever he wants? Right? So I think it brings a ton of questions into play, and I'm sure Thompson's sleeping on it and trying to figure out how to put those guys in spots to free their hands. But it's certainly concerning for a staff, and I'll just speak bluntly here because the whole world knows it. Like, this is a staff that, you know, is on a, you know, a hot seat's the wrong term, but like they are expecting production from this group. This is a senior Latin group with two absolute studs on the front end, and it's like their time. Like, that doesn't mean they have to win at all, but I think most Carolina lacrosse fans think this team's pretty solid, right? I don't know if the Big Ten lacrosse fans thinks Rutgers that good, and Jacksonville is Jacksonville, right? So there's not a single kid on Jacksonville's roster who wouldn't go to UNC if he had been offered in high school. So it's just interesting. And now, the flip side of this is they survived. Like, a win's a win. It doesn't really matter. And Breschi will have their full attention both this week and the rest of the month. Like, you know, that was their like cardiac event moment, right? Almost losing at home in their opener. So yeah, I'll pause there.
I don't have much to add. I think the last point is the right one, which is this is a game that gets forgotten about in 2-3 weeks if everything goes the way that Carolina fans expect it to go. I do think, to the point that you made about Duffy's lack of production, it's kind of hard not to wonder whether there's an injury situation there, given his injury history over the course of the last couple of years. So that bears watching. And really, beyond that, not much more to say. I do want to hear what your thoughts were on Syracuse 20, St. Joe's 2, especially when it comes to the storyline coming away from Syracuse's game against Boston U being their inability to clear against the 10-man, and then how that could potentially play into St. Joe's hands because of their kind of high-pressure, high-tempo style. Got anything on the Orange going to 2-0 and the Hawks falling to 0-1?
I mean, I think the only takeaways anyone can have is that Cuse looked amazing. Like, they looked both athletic at the point of attack. They were scoring in bunches from a lot of guys I've never heard of, which is a good thing, not a bad thing this time of year, because it means that they're developing depth and that they'll you know, be able to complicate the scout down the table outside of just the Spallinas and the knowns. you know, my fade reaction to open the year was predicated on a compliment. It's a compliment that I think the Grace kid's really good, and I think some of their defensive players last year, even some of their role midfielders, are like good players, and that's one of the reasons that they beat Princeton and made it to the Final Four. But listen, Cuse has the best home field advantage in the sport. It is a huge opportunity heading into this Friday where they seem healthy and poised to potentially get the type of win that can dramatically lighten the burden of how hard your path is to Championship Monday. Like, there is no question that John Tillman is going to be a 1, 2, 3, or 4 seed this year. So if you knock him off this Friday, what that does to your, you know, your math and where you shake out on the head-to-head, right? That, like, because this is, let's just jump to it. This is like what the Cuse fans care about. That's how you avoid like a Duke in the quarters, or that's how you avoid, you know, a loaded Princeton team or whoever, where you're in like an overtime game at Hofstra and the whole world, you know, like Cuse just wants to walk to the Final Four this year, obviously. But they look great. They just got to stay healthy. I think that they're doing the right thing of like testing out different pieces and combinations of how to replace the Spelina Hiltz connection, specifically on man up. Like I felt like they were doing some new things. March was this year, in terms of how they were floating under their 3-3 and spinning it through X. So yeah, they look great. And St. Joe's is not like Taylor Ray's a stud. That culture didn't die overnight, right? Like that's a good win. Is St. Joe's worse this year? Probably, but they're certainly not like a, you know, nothing to sneeze at.
Let's pick up the pace a little bit. It was a big Friday of action. A lot of teams reschedule their games from Saturday to Friday in order to get in front of the really substantial wins that created such frigid environments. And the day started with another eyebrow-raising result, and it deserves to be coupled with St. Joe's only putting up 2 goals because it looked for a time like Drexel might actually shut out Delaware. They ended up winning 11-1, and the Blue Hens fall to 0-2.
This was the most shocking result of the weekend, no question. And it calls into a lot, you know, our view on Utah, I think. There's like the read-through connectivity there. Like, is Delaware just really bad? Remember, this is 6 days after they got thumped. Like, you would think DeLuca would have had their attention, right? But, you know, good for Steve Boyle. Dear friend of mine, great dude. So that's a big win.
That's where I was going to go next, to Durham, where Utah, coming off of that win over Delaware that opened the season in Chase Fieldhouse, you know, played relatively tough as opposed to being a two-thirds, one-third game. It was a little bit more of a one-third, two-thirds game. But ultimately, you know, trailed 9-4 at half en route to a 14-7 loss to the Blue Devils. You know, I think Duke was a team that we just, you know, I don't want to say wanted to take a wait-and-see approach, but, you know, there was enough newness, enough freshness, that, you know, we didn't have an opportunity to talk about their win over Bellarmine because we had recorded on Sunday and that game was on Monday, and Max Lote was incredible at 5 goals. And, you know, coming back, you would have imagined, right, like we're going to kind of overreact to the knowns, so to speak, and try to take away those guys. And it was an everybody eats scenario offensively. Defensively, Ryan Steins, 1 goal and 4 assists. Anything on the Blue Devils win over the Utes?
I think what's going to frustrate the world is their out-of-conference schedule is just extremely soft up front. So, like, there's a very real chance, right, they win their next. I mean, it's Vermont, Jacksonville, St. Joe's, Air Force, Providence. Like, I don't know if we're going to learn anything about the Blue Devils for a while outside of what we know now, which is they're freakishly athletic. They have way too many middies playing, but they're all kind of producing. And, you know, it's just a question of, like, that March 28th game against Syracuse, we're going to learn a lot about both sides of the ball. But listen, this is an appropriate time to bring it up. Like, the whole college football world has rethought how they out of conference schedule. Like, does anyone actually blame them if they're going to end, you know, because remember, they've removed the Princeton Penn trap road trip where both those teams came in on like a Friday, Saturday and went to Durham and Chapel Hill, right? Which really sad for lacrosse fans. That was one of the funner, you know, kind of, I think, moments in the season the last few years was like that kind of bizarre budding rivalry between those four schools. But, you know, listen, they're in prime position to keep rolling here and figure out, you know, Caputo, because they did the flip, right? It's Caputo on the offensive side now? Or did I just make that up?
Well, the way I – no. The way I understand it is Matt Danowski's coaching the attackmen, Ryan Caputo's coaching the midfielders, yeah, and Understein's the defensive coordinator.
Got it. So Matt and Caputo will have a ton of time and tape, both in practice reps and game reps, to kind of – figure out who their best, let's call it, nine are by the time, you know, Syracuse comes to Durham. So it's, you know, last week I picked him to go to the Final Four. So I think I'm probably out in front of my skis versus the world on this one.
No, I love that.
Partially because of the schedule and the truth around what that means for seeding, which sucks in our sport, by the way. It shouldn't be that way, but it is. So we'll see.
You mentioned Delaware losing to Drexel was the most eyebrow-raising result of the weekend. The craziest result of the weekend was 14 Fairfield 14, Lehigh 13 in double overtime. This was a game in which I believe Lehigh scored the last six goals before getting scored upon late in the fourth quarter. Excuse me, they scored at least seven straight goals before getting scored upon late in the fourth quarter when they were still in their 10-man, and that allowed Fairfield to, I believe, tie the game. And then ultimately it was Devin Lamprun with the snow slide in double overtime to undo what was otherwise an incredible statistical performance from Luke Breslin, two goals and six assists, and Finn Morgan, six goals and one assist. Would have been really hard pill for Andrew Baxter and his group to swallow if they had let the lead that they built through three quarters slip away. But ultimately, they were able to emerge with a chilly but very fun double overtime win.
Yeah, great goal, great Sally. And I'm focused on Fairfield. I'll be at the tailgate Saturday morning, so I'll stop there.
Last one I want to touch on is Michigan 14, Marquette 7. We were hoping that we were going to have Coach Osello, who visited with the Michigan staff a couple weeks ago. But what I wanted to call out was, in football and to a lesser degree basketball, compared to lacrosse, I feel like when there are significant tactical or schematic changes implemented, they're easier to see. And kind of hidden within that point is that a lot of lacrosse offense is like pretty similar. To call it homogenous is probably too strong, but it's similar, right? Michigan's offense between last year and this year is about as different as I can recall any two offenses being. And what stood out so dramatically is, you know, Scott Beda's style or scheme is very well known for not only the volume of picks, not only for how reliant it is in on-ball screens, but also the way in which the screens are set. And I believe it was 2 years ago on this podcast that Jerry Byrne described that, you know, the way that Michigan set screens under Beda was basically you would set it, you would take one step and reset. And so it always looked like a moving pick and rarely was, but also put the – well, number one, it put the defense in a difficult position because the defender had to effectively reevaluate the angle and position. And when I say defender, I'm referring to both the guy who's about to get screened and the guy who's guarding the screener, which is going to determine the angle that he's going to be at, which is going to determine whether or not they're going to hedge, pinch, double, switch, whatever. But also just the official, right, in terms of whether or not they're ever going to call moving screens, because if everything's a moving screen, nothing's a moving screen. That's something that Pete Carroll taught us about pass interference about 12 years ago with the Legion of Boom. Michigan doesn't screen for the ball really at all anymore. And what was wild was their efficacy of just perimeter passing and the way in which it was well-timed with interior C-cutting and how often it was Nick Rude who was on the beneficiary's kind of receiving end of that, scored five goals. And it felt like what was so interesting was the diversity of where the feeds were coming from, because they were not relying exclusively on feeding from X. They were not relying exclusively from feeding on the wing. And they did have a couple of really nice top-down feeds as well. So I'm going to keep my eye on the Michigan offense, because I think the benefit of the being so on-ball screen reliant is the repeatability and sustainability of it, whereas being really perimeter passing oriented can make you, in my opinion, a little bit more susceptible to a bad day. the kind of number one example that I always used for that is the Grant Ament Penn State offenses, how when Grant was so good at throwing 20 to 25 yard assist passes, when it worked, it looked more beautiful than anything else in lacrosse that I can recall. But there were days when it just wasn't on, right? And I would compare it to the reliance on a three-point shooting offense, very much in the Golden State Warriors kind of vein of things. And so the sustainability, repeatability of Michigan's offense relative to what we saw, you know, certainly in the years that they made those Big Ten championship runs, is going to be what I've got my eye on in year one of Will Corgan.
Yeah, I really like that call out. And just to double down on that, like, unique screening is a very good way to be hard to plan against. What it does do is if your entire offense is used to setting picks and you play a bad defensive midfield group, you're actually bailing them out because you're allowing them to play sides and not like actually have to, you know, do what lacrosse is meant to be, which is like chunk and run. So it can work against you. But there's a reason, you know, indoor offenses and a lot of the college game now tries to mimic what is the nation's movement, which is moving screens. So no question that it's logical. And just a good use case that Terry just represented, which is like it's always important to see which big programs have had coordinator switches and, you know, alternative tendencies on, either on the back or the front end, you know, where you have a coordinator who wants to do things very differently. But I thought Michigan looked good. And I also just wanted to say, because I was thinking as you were talking, obviously an incredibly emotional weekend for Marquette. And I think our hearts at this podcast, but also really the whole lacrosse world, are thinking about those guys. And, you know, I'm dear friends, obviously, with Matt Caputo's older brother. So I think about him often and what that room went through this fall. So just, you know, it's one of those where you want good outcomes for Marquette. They obviously, you know, they want to win for those guys and they want to play well. So, I, you know, pulling for those guys to get it together.
Yeah, for sure. And it's true for Siena as well. You know, they lost in their opener to BU and have their home opener coming up. An announcement from the IMLCA today that they're naming a humanitarian award in Liam Gleason's honor. For those unaware, we haven't talked about it on the tailgate. I think we talked about it on other Inside Lacrosse podcasts. Liam, 41 years old, died of injuries after an accident in early December, and just a truly tragic situation. So any positives that can come out of that, you know, are certainly hoped for as well. So tough end of the year for the lacrosse community. And certainly, you know, as we get the opportunity to play these medicine games that count, a lot of folks trying to find that medicine, in the stick and the ball and the opportunity to compete. Larkin, I think that's a good note to end on. When we come back a week from now, we will have some incredible games to talk about, and hopefully they will happen at their originally scheduled time so that everybody who has made plans around those originally scheduled times are able to keep them. My man, I'll give you one final word on this edition of the Tailgate Podcast.
No, enjoyed it. You know, hopefully Mother Nature starts to cooperate here and we can get some increasing attendance results. But listen, it's a huge slate this weekend. Like that game in Upstate is about as good as it gets. Like if you're within 2 hours of the dome, you know, I'd be making the drive because that's showtime. That's why I play.